The Mike Lupica Podcast.
We are back now with the great Mike Lupica. He's one of the country's
most prominent
sports
columnists. Mike Lupica has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game the other night. Everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In your face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A $1 billion industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on the Mike Lupica Podcast. Today, we'll be talking with one of the hottest guys in television. He is currently the executive producer, showrunner, co-creator of the hit Showtime series Billions, the multi-talented Brian Koppelman. But before we get started with Brian, a word from Gillette. Every morning I use my Gillette razor, I know what I'm getting, a great shave. It's been a consistent part of my daily routine and my dad's for such a long time. My dad used a Gillette, so there was never anything else in our family. My Pro Glide and Fusion Cream give me the close, comfortable shave I'm looking for. Gillette offers a variety of shaving products for every guy. The new Gillette 3 and Gillette 5 razors start at $7.99 and deliver even more options for every guy by offering trusted quality at an affordable price. The Gillette 3 and the Gillette 5 are both available in stores. For guys looking to get Gillette Performance delivered to their door, you can find Gillette 5 at GilletteOnDemand.com. Check it out today. That's GilletteOnDemand.com. Welcome back to the Mike Lupica Podcast. We have been wanting to do this since the season of Billions ended, but we are lucky enough to have my friend Brian Koppelman on with us today. There is no hotter show anywhere on television right now than Billions, which is the creation of him and his partner David Levine and Aaron Ross Sorkin. David and Brian, who I have known from other areas, which we'll get into tonight, are the guiding forces behind this show. And I first met Brian Koppelman at Madison Square Garden, and he was sitting with his son, Sammy, who I was horrified to discover is now old enough to have graduated from college just the other day. And we shared a love of New York basketball and a love of William Goldman, who I just saw the other day. And I have told him this before, but I will tell him again today, he can't possibly have enough success with Billions to suit me. And Brian, first of all, welcome. And second of all, we have to talk about an ending to this season that I only you and David saw coming.
Thank you. Well, first of all, Mr. Lupica, sir, thanks for having me here. You know how much I love you, and so I love talking to you. And yeah, Sammy was three, and that was when there still seemed to be a possibility. I walked up to you, and we had just finished our movie Rounders, and I said, come, I introduced myself, and I said, please come to our premiere of that movie. And we've been friends ever since. And thanks, I'm so glad the show hits you, and you know, you've been so incredibly supportive of the show, which we completely appreciate right from the beginning. The ending, you know, Dave and I had this in our heads early that...
Wait a minute, early in the writing of this season, Brian, or did you always... we don't have to do spoiler alert now. People haven't seen it by now, screw them, okay?
Well, I'll say this to you. Yeah, that's fine. You either stop the podcast and watch, or we're about to talk about the show. So, you know, there are these think of it as like, well, you're such a, I mean, you write all these books, so you understand plotting. There were possibility trees at the beginning, right? So at the very beginning, you understand there are ways that could go. But between the second and third season that summer, as Dave and I were both thinking about the show before we opened the writer's room to have other writers join us and help us, we started talking about where it could go. And this image showed up in our heads of this thing up in the middle of the season where they briefly worked together. And then we realized if we teased it in that way and then ended it with these three people, suddenly that notion of the three of them sitting at that table came into our minds. And once we had that, we then understood where the whole season was going. So then you're writing the whole season knowing you're drilling to there. But when you had 300 at the beginning, the moment we came up with the Taylor character, we knew that they were going to be Axe's ultimate opponent.
Right, right.
And that became clear to us.
We're talking to Brian Koppelman about Billions. And again, if you don't want to know how season three ended, stop listening right now. But Brian, I've always said this, and we both love the movies, and the happiest a movie theater ever was in my life, I don't know if we ever talked about this before, is when Robert Redford opened his eyes at the end of Sting and you knew that you'd been had, that he hadn't been shot, that he hadn't been killed, that he and Newman, and I watched it in Boston. I was at some sports event there, and it was the happiest a movie theater had ever been. When that door opened at the end of the last show, and it was Axe standing there, I had the same feeling, and I almost called you and said, "Oh yeah, you got me, you got me."
Oh, that's great! I love that. First of all, any comparison to The Sting, which is clearly a foundational film for Dave and me, I remember watching that movie at summer camp, and loving it. And the two of us have been, you know, obsessed with that idea, the way those cons work, that movie, House of Games, the Oceans movies, which one of which we wrote. They all go back, by the way, to a book by a guy named David Maurer, who was an anthropologist and sociologist, and wrote a book called The Big Con in the 40s about all the different kinds of short and long cons.
Right,
and
right.
The big plot stuff in many movies like The Sting and House of Games all comes out of that book, which if you've never read, someone's got to get it for you. You will freak out.
Well, but Brian, and the thing about The Sting too, and the whatever they did afterwards, it was never going to be the same. And it's why, if we want to circle back and stay with The Sting for a second, the beauty of Billions, one of the beauties of Billions is you love running cons on us. And we, you know, my sons are saying the other day, Dad, we love it when they do that flashback, you know, that ocean
yeah.
stuff. And that's clear. Clearly, these are pitches that you guys can throw for strikes constantly and constantly surprise us with them.
Well, we're always thinking about it. And then, you know, Tarantino said this thing that Dave and I heard toward the beginning of our career that really stayed with us, which is the audience is so sophisticated now, it's so smart, that it's like when you've ridden a roller coaster, when you've ridden lots of roller coasters, the first time you're on Space Mountain, even though you're surprised, you kind of start leaning before the turn. And so we have to be aware that the audience is leaning before the turn. So we have to be really careful about when we throw those turns at you so that you're, you know, surprised and thrilled in the way that you want to be. And one of the things is for us in this show, they come out of character. You can always go back and understand, okay, well, that character was slighted in that spot. And that character didn't appreciate that person in that way. And so you can understand why the characters do what they do. And then we also try to get, like you said, sometimes we'll flash back and show the pieces of how they did it.
Well, we're talking to Brian Koppelman on the Gillette Hotline today. It goes back to what Bill Goldman calls reversals. You guys are great at reversals. Okay. But I have to tell you it. And again, when I watch the show, I just want to hear him talk. I mean, I love the plot. I love the story. I love the hairpin turns. I love all that. Okay. But it's like, you know, it's like a Sorkin movie. It's like reading an Elmore Leonard book. I just am happy listening to them talk. And I have to tell you though, as we got into season three, I was thinking, I love this show. I want this show to run forever, but how far can they go with this steel cage match between these two characters? And by the way, if the steel cage match had lasted for 7 years, I would have been happy. But this curveball you threw us now, it had to be a thing where you thought, oh my God, now this opens up a whole bunch of doors and windows just open.
Listen, what you say about the dialogue and the way they talk, we have these, you know, this is a group of actors, it's an incredibly rare thing that you get this level of actor so deep in the bench of the show. You know, in every spot you have somebody who can really, really nail it. And so it just inspires us as writers. And you're right. You could listen to these people talk and say anything over and over again. And it really is just an incredible thing. And Dave and I, along with our casting director, Allison Estrin at Showtime, we're super careful about who we're going to add in to this ensemble, both as actors and as people. Because the other thing, you know, that a clubhouse that truly gets along and plays well together is a rare thing. And our clubhouse, we just all fucking get along. Every person is super prepared every day. So that Damian Lewis shows up, man, he not only knows all his lines, he understands everything about the scene. Same with Giamatti and Asia Kate Dillon and Maggie Siff and right down the line. And that is not a typical experience. That is a rare experience. So Dave and I have huge incentive to keep this thing going because we love showing up for work every day.
Oh, no. We're talking to Brian Koppelman on the Gillette Hotline. When I was saying I love to listen to him talk, back in the day when you were just a child, Mike Burke ran the Knicks and the Garden. And Tony Kornheiser was still in the newspaper business at that time. And we were talking one day and he said, yeah, I was talking to Mike Burke the other day. And I said, are you writing a column for him? He said, and Tony said, no, sometimes I call him up because I just like to listen to him talk. And you know, that's the way I feel about Billions. There's one guy we got to talk about. And I want to go through the various cast members and I'll try not to slight anybody, but your history with Malkovich and this, talk about a pitch that he could hit, this bad Russian in this season, but it began with Rounders. And this is a long way around for me to ask you this, because I don't think I've ever asked you, why do you think Rounders is such a cult movie? And I don't have to go any further than Christopher, Alex, and Zach Lupica, all of whom, I swear, have the movie memorized.
Well, yeah, I love that. I would say a couple things. One, again, it goes to these actors, but I'll say that Dave and I had this, our intention was to write a movie that would work. We had no idea we could pull this off, but we wanted to write a movie that would get better on repeated viewings, the way that movies like Diner and Stripes were for us.
Yep.
There were movies when we were young. As you know, Dave and I are best friends since we were teenagers. And so we would watch these movies over and over again, and we would start quoting strange moments from them, strange lines from them in strange circumstances in our lives. And I think that when, and even up through college, like a movie like Mamet's House of Games. And I think we chose this strange language for that movie, right? They don't even speak English really in the beginning of it. Are you going to sit the apple and all this weird sort of stuff that we sort of created or took from old poker language. It wasn't the way people actually talked in the poker world in New York. But I think what it did was the same way when someone's whispering, you lean in. We created an insular world with a language and customs of its own. So if you did the work to get inside it, you felt really rewarded. You started to understand it. And you had these incredible actors. You got Turturro and Matt and Edward and Malkovich.
Yep.
And these guys are just delivering. And you could tell the other thing, and it's similar to Billions, is they all, you could tell the joy they took in that language and in that world and in playing those parts. And so it's contagious. And you're watching it, and you want to be friends with them. You want to be in there, in the demimonde of Rounders. And with John Dahl, who directed the film, Dave and I were on set every day. John Dahl came up with a visual identity for the movie that, again, sucks you in the same way that the language does. And, you know, we were just a minute ahead of the poker boom. And so it also made, to a group of young guys primarily, it just made poker seem incredibly cool and inviting. And that really is, at that time in our lives, we were hoping that a bunch of guys would go to college and just put that thing on, at the time, the VHS or the DVD, and they would just watch it over and over. The fact that it happened is just amazing to us. And, people started writing about it when it was on cable and all that stuff happened. So we were, I'll say, thrilled about it, though not really surprised. Like, it was our intention. We couldn't know whether it would happen, but we did intend it to happen.
So when you call Malkovich about how long did you have to take to describe this character before he said, what time do you need me there on Monday?
So I'm going to pull up the text. So we're sitting there in the writer's room, right? And we're trying to figure the thing out, you know, and we're sitting there in the writer's room. We're trying to figure the thing out, and we have it figured out, and we start writing it, and that first one is being written, and I'm sorry, I'm going to find this. It's worth the wait
because of how quickly
it happened. And so he just literally immediately said, yeah. So I wrote, hey, John, want to come play an oligarch for a couple episodes? Showtime will, you know, call and make an offer if you're game. David, I would love to have you. 1 minute later, he wrote back, of course I'm game. That was it.
Thank the Lord. Thank the Lord. Oh, my God. It was
and we
like...
were. I got to say, we were, you know, I didn't know. I'll say this. So he was in Rounders. Then he was in our second movie, which we directed, Knockaround Guys. So we have this real relationship with John. And through the years, whenever one of us was in the, we were in the same city, we would have dinner. And we've always been in touch. But, you know, he is still to us, John Malkovich. It's a huge, big deal. I can't play it off to you. Because as you know from what you do, the people who are there ahead of you, so all the people who do the thing once you're in it, they're your peers and they're your friends and you're not nervous around them. We're just all doing the thing. But the people the generation before you, even 10 years before, you never lose the thrill because before I knew John Malkovich.
No, it's Hamill and Breslin. It's Hamill and Breslin and Goldman. I never got over the fact that they were, you know, Pete and Bill are and Jimmy was a friend of mine. Never, never, never.
That's what I'm saying. So you never get so exactly. John is a friend, a collaborator. We've worked together for a long time. But to me, he's always the guy in the line of fire. You know, he's always the guy in those movies. And that moved me, that made me, you know, were part of the stuff that made me want to tell stories and all that shit. And so when I texted him, Dave was sitting with me and I sent the text. I really didn't know. But I'll say this about John Malkovich. That dude has proven us over 20 years. He is truly a person of his word. And as soon as he said, of course, I'm game, I walked into the writer's room and I said, we got Malkovich going to come do the show. And I knew that there was no chance he would back out. I knew he would come and be ready and kill it. And I have to say, Mike, when he walked on set, even the most veteran actors, when he came to it, freaked out. They couldn't really handle that John Malkovich was in the scenes. The directors of the episodes got nervous. It was intense to watch. And John just is a pains to make everybody feel comfortable, but everybody reacts like there's a giant among us.
We're talking to my friend Brian Koppelman, who has a huge monster hit ongoing called Billions. All right. I was lucky enough at the end of his life, for a long time at the end of his life, to be friends with one of the most underrated actors of all time, and that is Roy Scheider. And one of the great gentlemen. And we played softball together, and we had breakfast together at the Candy Kitchen out in Bridgehampton. And we're sitting there having breakfast one day, and we were talking about we're going to need a bigger boat, which is one of the great lines in the history of the movies from Jaws. And I said, when did you know that this was going to be a line that would live forever? And he said, we sat down for the first table read and they came around to me and I said it and everybody at the table screamed. He said, we came back the next day, we did the same read again. They came around to me and they screamed again. And he said, at that point, I said, that's a pretty good line. Okay, so again, this is a long way for me to ask you, did you know what you had, even on the page, until David started imagining the character of Wags?
So, you know, here's the story with Wags.
And I loved him in Suits, by the way. He was a great bad guy
in
Suits.
Well, he and I went to college together, and I always knew he was a home, you know, I know he's a home run. Like, just he was the best actor at college, and always knew the guy was going to make it and be the real thing. You know, they should make it. I knew he was the real thing, and that if there was any justice in the world, he'd be a really successful working actor. I knew that from when I was 18, 19 years old or something. Well, the first episode, Mike, of season one, the pilot episode, Wags is quite different. He doesn't have the goatee, and he's kind of mild-mannered. And we watched the pilot, and Dave and I looked at each other, and we realized we've blown an opportunity here. We, instead of having fire and ice with Axe and Wags, we have ice and ice. We have Damien doing his thing, and then Wags is supposed to be this really waspy, originally, this kind of reserved, waspy guy. So we cut one scene out of the pilot, and we took Costable to lunch, and we said, listen, we are making this character this whole other thing. He's going to be the id of Axe Capital, and we're going to write you this crazy shit and think about what you want your facial hair and your hair to look like and how you want to dress, because this role is doing a 180. And we knew the answer to the question. We knew Costable could do it. So when we wrote that conference scene for the second episode, which is when Wags really like comes out with a whole bunch of one-liners and it's suddenly this character. We had, it was very conscious. It was like, we have this actor. We know he can do this. We have to set him up to knock him out of the park. And then he did it. And when he did it, everybody was like, holy shit, this is amazing. And some people asked us if we were pushing too far, and Dave and I have held really firm. And we said, no, no, no. We know exactly what we want. We know why we need it. And Dave Costable just crushed it. So, you never know, but you really hope. And he has a line in that episode where he's like, about Tracy Lords. And we knew that when he said that line, like when we wrote that line and when he said it, we were like, okay, we've given, and that's actually in the second season. That's the opening episode of the second season. But as an example, we wrote that line and then we knew, okay, that's going to now go kind of viral and people are going to, you know, really respond. So the first season, I would say, we wrote all this stuff for him. We felt like it was going to work. Then when we saw it crush in the first season, we just amped it up for the second and third season.
Brian Koppelman is our guest on the Mike Lubica podcast. Much more with him after this from LinkedIn. A business is only as strong as its people, and every hire matters. So don't settle for posting and hoping the right person will find your role and apply. LinkedIn is more than the world's largest professional network. It's also a better way to find great talent. 70% of the U.S. workforce is already on LinkedIn. And because LinkedIn considers skills, experiences, location, and more to match and promote your job to potential candidates, businesses rate LinkedIn jobs 40% higher than job boards at delivering quality candidates. Go to LinkedIn.com/Lupica and get a $50 credit towards your first job post. That is LinkedIn.com/Lupica for your $50 credit today. Terms and conditions apply. You know, we're talking to Brian Koppelman on the Mike Lubica podcast. He's on the Gillette hotline today. You said Tracy Lords there. And here's another thing I love about Billions. You know, people are either going to get the references or they're not. You guys are running as fast as you can. Then you're passing the baton and people either get it or they don't. And the dialogue is written completely unapologetically.
Yeah, because look, we're mostly trying to make each other laugh. Dave and I are trying to make each other laugh. We write the scenes separately, and then we put the documents together. And Adam Perlman, who's our number two, is really great at this, and we have a great writing staff. And so, yeah, man, we'll throw them, you know. And we know that however old you are, you're going to get a certain number of the references. And with the Internet now, you can figure it out because people are on Twitter talking about it, and people ask us questions, and I'll answer questions on Twitter. But for me, the fun is these are little Easter eggs. You know, the scene has to make sense. If you don't, I would say this. We're conscious that the scene needs to make sense whether you get the references or not. If you get the references, then it goes deeper and deeper. It's that thing Hemingway said, like, the story is the story, and then whatever you bring to it tells you how much else you're going to get out of it. Not that it's on the level of Hemingway, but that's the idea.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to sound like an odd reference, but probably not to you. This is like the front page. This is like a Howard Hawks movie where it's coming fast and the dialogue's coming fast and they're talking over each other and you better freaking pay attention, because if not, you're going to have to go back and rewind it, because you're going to know you missed a great line.
I was in the front page when I was like 16 in a camp production of it, and I played Hildy, and it's amazing how fast you have to go. And like, yes, exactly right. The speed of that play and just the incredible amount of dialogue is amazing. I didn't get to see the production that Rudin put up last year. How was it? Was it good?
Oh, it was terrific. Oh no, it was terrific. And guys I knew were in it, and it was.
We were shooting. I really wanted to go, and we were shooting, and I couldn't get there. Because I do love the play, and I love that as a reference.
Danny Master Giorgio was in it, and all of a sudden, but I have to tell you, this is really funny. I met Danny Master Giorgio when he was in Lucky Guy with my buddy Mike Gaston.
And he's a great guy. He was in two episodes of Billions. Great guy.
No, I know. But so we get to the theater, and I didn't know Danny was in the front page. And so Taylor Lupica and I are sitting there and we weren't going to go backstage and do any of that stuff, which we ended up doing. And Danny comes walking in act one. And so at intermission, I went outside and this is the modern world. And and texted him and said, holy shit, I didn't know you were in Front Page. And I'm still texting with him as Act Two is starting.
Oh, no way, really?
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
And then we went, oh, no, he's terrific. And the Front Page was great. All right. Another question. I've seen you interviewed and I've heard you talk about Maggie Siff and how when she sat down, you said, okay, call off the contest line. We've got to win.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Asia Kate Dillon and the character of Taylor, who has become, will continue to be an iconic character for a bunch of different reasons in your show. And Asia Kate Dillon is going to go on and be a huge star after this. Tell me about the genesis of Taylor. And if it was as decisive when you met Asia as it was with Maggie.
Yeah, they came in. So we had started to hear about, gender non-binary people. And my kids, one was in college, one was in high school, and they told me stories about teachers asking genders and people announcing the genders. And as an, I was a 50-year-old white guy, I didn't know anything about this, And but as we heard about it, we found it fascinating and compelling, start researching, and we decided we wanted this character who would seem from the outside like they weren't someone acts would necessarily gravitate toward, but that they were intrinsically, so if they weren't extrinsically, but they were intrinsically, there was something in them that acts would see. And we realized this would be a perfect sort of character to bring into this environment, but then you have to find the actor to play the part.
Right.
And similarly to casting Wendy, and for this role, we read cis men, cis women. We read gender non-binary people who were assigned male at birth, assigned female at birth, all this stuff to try to find the person.
But Brian, let me just stop you right there. And are you thinking, and you know that this is a great character, but is there a part of you thinking, okay, David and I, we can't screw this up. This is important.
Yes.
This is important beyond our show.
Well, at the time, here's the thing about making a show that I know you have a lot of other friends who've done this. You have this plan. So our plan for Taylor was this long plan. Like, we did know that this thing that would happen at the end of last season would happen when we invented the character. But if we miscast the role, you would just change we would have changed course. You know what I mean? So that two episodes in, we would have somehow gotten that character off the show and found... Right. If the actor, that is one of the things about the people who aren't. Instead, midway through that season, we made Asia a regular on the show and kept going deeper and deeper and further and further. So we start auditioning people, and it is impossible. Luckily for us, there were two actors who were, it came down to. But Asia came back for a callback and just knocked it out of the park. It was one of those moments you're sitting there and you're giving them direction and you realize, oh wait, this actor is as smart as the character. I couldn't have counted on that, that you could have an actor show up who actually understands. I'm not saying that Asia understands math as deeply as Taylor does, but I will tell you that Asia is an incredibly nuanced and deep and quick thinker in the way that Taylor is. And so that those things just lined up, and so Levine and I and Showtime all understood, and we did understand that we wanted to chew a tremendous amount of story with this character. And I can't tell you I knew that because you don't know how the show is going to hit, so I didn't know for sure that the world was going to react the way that they did, but I hoped so, and I felt like it could do some good. And I mean, Asia gets letters all the time about... from a grandmother who suddenly can understand their transgendered granddaughter or grandson, and a father who made up with their child, or a sister who understands their, was a sister, now their brother. And I will say, like, what an incredible thing to be a part of.
Oh,
it wasn't our intention. What I mean? But what a great unintended consequence. Really so satisfying.
You are of that world, and the frame of reference I always use is Alan Alda as Hawkeye Pierce.
Love it.
Some other actor that with Larry Gelbart, right? And the writers that they had on MASH, Hawkeye was going to be a great character, but he wouldn't have been that character if it hadn't been Alan Alda. And
100%.
And you go
it's a perfect
and I go
analogy.
And you go, and I, you know, I've got the cast list right in front of me. Chuck Rhodes, Paul Giamatti, you can't imagine how anybody else could have been Chuck Rhodes. You can't imagine anybody except Damian Lewis playing Bobby. You can't imagine anybody except Maggie Siff playing Wendy Rhodes.
No, it's totally true. And you know, we feel, look, we did it really well. I mean, one of the big benefits of doing that at a slightly older age is we'd lived through making mistakes on other stuff or not having it be exactly the way we wanted. And on this show, we just aren't very compromising. We are collaborative with the network, and the network sees the same show that we see. But we are just making the show that we want to make with the people we want to make it with. We have these incredible partners, and we've delivered for them. So everybody understands that it's working.
It's Elmore, the great, my great friend, the great Elmore Leonard said, "I write to please myself." And it's so clear that you guys are doing, all right. We didn't do this the last time. Toby Leonard Moore. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Now you talk about some, you have thrown us some head fakes with this character and what a brilliant actor this young man is.
Well, you know, the fact that he's an Australian kid is something that, like, almost no one knows. And that he, you know, he came in, he and Condola Rashad came in, and each one at their audition, basically, we were done. We knew we had him, you know. I mean, that is the thing almost down the line. Toby is brilliant. I'll say this is the other piece of this, is that all these people are super high IQ people. So Toby was a lawyer, educated as a lawyer. He speaks Japanese. His mother is the most famous voiceover cartoon. She's the Mel Blanc of Australia and New Zealand. And he has incredible dexterity and can kind of get the kick out of the weird things we have Connerty do. And, we knew early on, and we told Toby before the season started how the season would end. And I'll say what's great about this cast is a lot of the time actors would really enjoy the firing of someone more than the getting fired. But the day that Toby got fired by Giamatti, Toby had the best time. He kept coming up to us being like, "Mate, I get the front row seat for this shit. Unbelievable." You know, and he loved playing that. So, you know, Giamatti spitting in his face. I mean, he loved it. So they're real gamers, Mike.
Hey, and I know that Terry Kinney's only been in about half of the episodes, but every time I look at Terry Kinney, Brian, here's what I think. Remember how, you know, Michael Avenatti, Stormy Daniels' lawyer, and yeah, Stormy have told the story about the guy coming, you know, up to her.
Of course.
Tell me that you don't believe that could have been Terry Kinney. That character would have gone up. That
Hall, yes, sir.
Hall absolutely would have been the one that the Trump guys sent to scare Stormy Daniels.
The only difference being if Hall did it, it would work. But
and she never would have been heard from again.
That's right. Hall would have just handled it. Well,
he's so creepy, scary, good. Oh man,
Terry's so scary. So, but Terry really did us a favor on the pilot. Terry was in my wife's movie, I Smile Back, and I'd asked him the favor then. He's really close friends with Matt Damon, who, as you know, is our Dave and my friend, and we've made a couple movies with Matt and had met Terry socially with him a few times.
Yeah.
And loved Terry and loved his work, you know, forever. He started Steppenwolf with Malkovich and was movies as diverse as The Firm and starred in Oz. And I needed this character to help Amy in her movie, this one-day part. And I called Terry and I was like, "Look, this is a great thing. It's a scene with Sarah Silverman. I want Sarah surrounded by really incredible veteran actors. We can't pay anything. We'll give you a sandwich. Will you come do it?" And Terry said, "Yeah, I'd love to." So he comes and does the thing. He's actually got 104 fever. He doesn't cancel on us. He's amazing. Kills it. And I write him and I say, "Listen, Terry, we're doing this show. It's not a regular part, but if you're in the mood to come hang out," and like really before I finished, he's like, "Whatever you want, I'm in. You're my friend." It's like, "What is it?" And I said, "I think it'll grow into something." And you know, he just went, it was like Malkovich in a way. If you're someone who knows the theater and knows who Terry Kinney is, when he walks on a set, it's a big deal. And you're like, it headed to the pilot of our show, that scene when Hall brings the bag to, shows up, meets Axe under those pipes, and tells him who he has to go after, and they exchange the bag of money. there's something going on there where you're like, the show can go deep. It can go below the surface. And, you know, we had that moment where Terry's with the little person early on in the first season too. And Terry's just, again, he's another gamer where he just really gets a kick out of what this character is. He understood him right away. And it was fun this year when we did the head fake of making the audience think Terry was out of the show for the first few episodes. And there were those two other guys. And we knew, you know, I'd get all these tweets of people waiting and waiting and waiting. And it was great to know we had this secret reveal of, don't worry, you know, Hall is going to be back and it's going to be fucking great when he comes back. And that worked out was awesome. I remember talking to Terry before the season, and he was like, hey, are you guys really bringing me back? Are you cutting me out? If you need to cut me out, and we were like, oh, dude, episode 7, it's going to be amazing. But we couldn't imagine making the show without Terry. He's such a part of the family of the show.
We're talking with my friend Brian Koppelman on the Mike Lupica podcast. More with Mr. Koppelman in a minute, but first a word from Geico. There's a quick way you could save money. Just switch to Geico. All it takes is 15 minutes to find out if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. And Geico offers coverage for more than just car insurance. Got a motorcycle? Geico's got you covered. Got an RV? Covered. Got a boat? Covered. How about a homeowner's or renter's insurance? You bet Geico's got you covered. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save. That's geico.com. There's so many guys that in this ensemble that there's a scene that is one of my favorites with a kid. I call him a kid. I think a lot of these guys are kids. With Ben Kim is explaining how Taylor didn't turn him. And I, you'll remember the exact line of dialogue, but when it becomes clear that because he didn't get turned, he's asking for a raise, and basically said, but I don't remember what he said, but it was along these lines. Please consider what you're about to say next.
Yeah. Well, I think it's finish what you're about to say at your own peril. It's something like that. No, he's great. That kid, man, that kid could have been a star of silent movies. Daniel Isaac, who plays
Daniel Isaac, he's one of those guys. What had Daniel Isaac been in?
No, very little, like little parts and things, you know. And what's great, and this is like, if anyone out there is listening and wants to be in any sort of demanding field, you know, what Ben Kim had to do the first year of the show is really difficult to do. You know, you show up, you got to be present, you're getting paid almost nothing, you might have a line in the episode,
you're basically sitting in front of a terminal, basically.
Yeah, you're basically there to say like one informational line an episode. And I'll tell you, this kid, not only didn't he ever complain about it, but he brought something to every single time he had to say a line. And he didn't bring something in a sticky way where it was like, oh, come on, dude, calm down. It was just like exactly what the guy would do. And at the table reads, we would have these table reads. And at a table read, you have the main actors, and then sometimes you'll have some actors who have only a couple lines do other parts. And Ben Kim would come to these, you know, Daniel Isaac would come to these table reads, and he would do his Ben Kim line, and then whatever else he had to do, he would nail it. And about 7 episodes in, Levine and I look at each other, we're like, that kid's a thoroughbred. Like, we can write to that kid.
Yep.
And he didn't ask us to, but just slowly you start realizing, oh, he can really perform. And so you give him more and you give him more. And then as what happens on our show is you learn about his life. And I'm sure when you've spoken with David Simon or Chase or anyone, you know, you start to learn about these actors' lives and then you use bits of it in the show. So he has a Korean mother who is sometimes disappointed with him about the way, you know, that he's doing this for a living and not a doctor. And so you can just put that stuff in a way in Ben Kim's mouth, and then it makes it more fun for the actor to be able to like lock into, you know.
Well, I can't wait. So how far are you into the writing of season 4?
Well, we've outlined a bunch of it, and David and I are writing the first episode now. Like, we'll have a draft by the end of the weekend. We'll have a draft that'll be pretty close to the first episode done.
All right. And I'll tell you something. We can't talk about Trump today. It just depresses me.
I'm fine not to talk about him.
I can't. I wrote about it the other day, that this is as bad a week as our country's had in a long time. So let's talk about a much more uplifting subject for you, the Knicks.
You're going to bring up the Knicks. I knew it. You're going to bring up the Knicks.
And I don't know, like,
I asked everybody how the kid is. People seem to like the kid. I watched the tape of his work.
Cal likes him, but Cal likes all his kids. So you can't
Listen, here's the thing, what Cal says.
I'm not
going to learn his name until he makes it safe and uninjured to the first game of the season and scores a basket.
All right. So I see a headline on Twitter yesterday from my paper. And Stephen Bondi's a terrific young basketball writer, son of my pal Philip Bondi. And I knew this was coming. It was like a wait for it, that Nick's now gearing up for 2019 free agents. And I tweeted this yesterday. I don't know if you saw it or not. And I'm thinking, it's fascinating to me how we are never talking with the Knicks about anything having to do with the year that we're actually living in. It's always another year. It's always another year.
Well, I've never seen anything like it in sports. I mean, for the people listening and just hearing me talk about the show, I mean, mostly before, I would say this, before Trump and before billions, my Twitter account was 90% the Knicks.
It was.
A central part of my, this is before you were even on Twitter, you know, but you knew me. I mean, I would write you emails and texts. Like, it's a central part of my existence. I mean, you wrote two articles about me and my son and the Knicks.
Yes,
literally,
I did. And Christopher Lupica, my oldest. Brian, you know this. Christopher Lupica grew up backstage with me in the 90s. And we've talked about this before. We did not appreciate fully at the time how good we had it, whether they won a championship or not. In a way, it was a longer great time than the glory Knicks had given us at the end of the 60s and the beginning of the 70s. Where you know what
it was
like.
Those years with the fights with Miami and all that
stuff. Oh, my God.
Those were great teams. But, Mike, it's been a long,
one.
Long,
you mean one playoff victory in 18 years?
Brutal time, and I don't really have. It's an odd thing to be for real. We're not going to go down now and get dour, but it is a strange time. As first of all, you can't compare the things, but to feel, you know, Cody Keenan, who wrote for Obama and is someone my son looks up to a great deal, said in a speech he gave yesterday. Hope is subversive now.
Yeah.
And it's kind of true. So, you know, I want the guys running the simulation we're all in to turn up the joy meter and turn down the horror show. And that goes for the Knicks and the United States of America at the moment, sadly.
Brian, you have to be in New York to appreciate how biblical what has happened to the Knicks is. No, because people outside, we've talked about this before. I love it when people say, well, the Garden's the Mecca. And I want to say, the Mecca of what? The Mecca of what? The Mecca of dysfunction and bad management and bad ownership. They have won. For people outside of New York, Brian Koppelman and I are going to tell you something. The Knicks have won one playoff series in 18 years. They are one of the famous franchises in professional sports, not just professional basketball. They once produced a team that my great friend Pete Hamill calls the Basie Band of basketball. DeBuscher and Reed and Bradley and Clyde and Earl the Pearl.
Count Basie you're talking about. Yeah, man, I'll tell you, part of me thinks that Joe Tsai and the new net ownership that's going to take over are going to build a winner before the Knicks are going to build a winner. Because they're hungry. Those guys win at everything they try. Joe Tsai made his money himself. And they have a lot of smart
They have a really good coach. Brian, they have a really good coach that only people on the inside know. But Kenny Atkinson is a terrific basketball coach.
So I wouldn't be surprised if the Nets figure this out. They got a lot of smart people around them. I can't switch my allegiance, but I... although I don't really, you know, what I do is I throw myself into watching golf and then other basketball teams. But I had dinner with Bill Bradley recently. I don't know him, but he's close and a friend of mine. And it pained me.
I know which friend.
Shut up. I hardly could talk to him about it because all I could say, you know, I could talk to him about Marvin Webster and Lonnie Shelton and the Knicks of the 70s. But it's very hard to gin up any enthusiasm about almost anything that's happened since Mason Starks were on the team. You know, I loved Sprewell, so I loved the Sprewell teams, Allen Houston and Sprewell, but that's it. You know, it was,
Then
nothing, man. Nothing.
All right. Before we go today, you are a fascinating case study for me, along with my friend Mike Greenberg of ESPN. And it is your devotion and your passion and your affection for Tiger Woods. And, yes, you know, I come at this in a completely different generational way. I grew up in a different time in golf. I've been playing golf since I was 9 years old. I loved watching what happened at Shinnecock. I love the whining because I think it's the greatest championship course in America. But your belief in Tiger is unshakable. Just talk about that for to me, it would be like someone who came to basketball because of Michael Jordan. And if you came to basketball because of Michael Jordan, it was never going to be Kobe. It was never going to be LeBron. It was never going to be anybody. And you feel that way about Tiger Woods.
I do. And I think it has to do with my son and my dad and me. And the time where I was in my... So here's where I was when Tiger won the Masters. And you have to understand, I started watching Tiger in the second U.S. amateur. So the second U.S. amateur that he won, I watched, and then I watched the third one. And I remember there was a golf magazine that came out right after that when he declared he was going to go pro, and they interviewed 50 experts about golf. Every golf commentator and old veteran, and out of the 50, zero of them felt he'd win the first year. Some said he'd never win. Only one or two said he'd get a major. They all said it was too soon. And I remember reading that article at 29 years old and thinking, these guys are pat. They don't see it. They can't let themselves see that the Terminator is coming. They can't grapple with what it is, because I'd watched him play these tournaments and had read a lot about him even back then. So when he wins the Masters, here's where I am in my life. Dave and I just had sold the script for Rounders. I was on my first trip to California as a screenwriter, which was a month after we sold the script. We sold the script March 3rd, so like 6 weeks later, we come out, and it's the Masters. And I'm in my hotel room. We're supposed to have a bunch of meetings. And I remember actually that I was in a bar with Dave that had the Masters on in the afternoon when Tiger was four over, had shot 40 on the front nine.
Yes, he did. Yes,
and then
did.
I went back to my hotel and watched the back nine. And I watched...
I think he shot 40-30, didn't he?
Yeah, and I watched the comeback. And when he ends up, you know, coming all the way back on the back nine, I then, on Friday, wake up early because I'm in L.A., so it starts early. I watch the round Friday. And then, Mike, I don't leave my damn hotel room Saturday and Sunday until I call home. My son is a little boy then, and he's 2 years old. So there's nothing. He can't really watch it. I tell Amy to, like, show him the TV. But I watch Tiger do what he did. I watch him hug his father. And I am just bonded to that athlete. It was his dawning in that thing and mine as a new father. And I remember calling my dad and us watching together the end of when he's hugging him. I'm watching, talking to my father who's watching in New York. And watching that first year as just an unadulterated fan. And I'll tell you something else. Watching this kid who was multiracial, you know, who to me appeared to be at the time a black kid who was walking into these lily white establishments that refused Jews and refused black people and refused gay people and refused women. And suddenly he was forcing them to not only accept him, but to beg him to play their tournaments in their clubs.
Yeah, yeah.
There was something about it that represented everything right about the power of sports. Everything right about an individual saying, I can transcend my situation. And so when you're brought, did Tiger go off the rails? There's no, I cannot defend his off the course behavior. I'm not going to try to, but I will say I understand a lot of it because of what came at him, because of who his father was, you know, because of the various difficulties in his family's personal life. But watching him look, you see in Bobby Axelrod and Chuck Rhodes, and really in almost every character Dave and I've ever written, a big streak of loyalty and a big streak of, if you don't see who I am, go screw yourself.
Yep.
And Tiger's dose of, I know I'm special, and I'm going to work so hard. I'm going to work harder than anyone else to prove it to you. But you know what? If you don't want to back it, just get out of the way, because I'm going to push you out of the way. Something about that, and about the fact that he could back it all up, just moved me and continues to move me. For me, he's the greatest golfer who ever lived. You know, he didn't career. He stopped at 14. He may never get to 18. And I can't shout you down if you say Jack. There's no way I can make, in the same way that until LeBron gets six, Michael has every argument in the world. Jack has every argument in the world, right? Jack is Michael Jordan in this scenario. But for in the same way LeBron to my son is the greatest basketball yep. player who ever lived, for me, Tiger Woods is above the game in every way. And I think that everyone was waiting for him to fail, and they rooted for him to fail, even though he brought millions of dollars into the game, because golf is still deeply racist. You know, you walk around Augusta, and it's this incredible place, but you feel, yay, they admitted three people of color. You know what I mean? It's still stacked. The deck is still really stacked against the outsider. And Tiger, is as an outsider, became the ultimate insider. And so there's something about that that I find moving. Does that make any sense to
you? It makes complete sense. The Michael, I'm glad we got into this talking about Michael, because it's, yes, it and by the way, it doesn't have to be logical. I can probably out-debate you on Jack because of not only 18 majors but 19 seconds and the fact that he took on in their prime and beat them Arnold and Trevino and Watson and it, you know, and
sure.
But I come, it's what you just described is the beauty of sports. It's the great Seymour Seawolf of the Elias Sports Bureau once said, and he was talking about Mays and Mantle, but for this conversation, it's I say Jack and you say Tiger. And it's the air in between us. And that air yes. and that conversation is the essence of why we love any kind of high art, not just sports, but, you know, the kind of high art that you guys are producing on Billions. My friend, thank you for doing this today.
My pleasure. And lastly, I'll just say this about Tiger, which is, if and when he wins again, man, you will find me as glued with my dad and my son, because the three of us have just watched all these things together. So we're on the phone and texting.
Oh, I get it. Brian, the day Jack won the Masters in 86, I probably made a dozen calls to my dad on the back nine. Just on the back nine.
I love it. Of course.
And that, again, that Sammy and you and your dad is my boys and me and my dad. Again, I will repeat what I said at the start of this. Not enough good things can happen to you with this show and whatever comes next and whatever comes after that. Brian Koppelman of Billions, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, man.
This is the kind of, we could have gone on for an hour and a half. This is the kind of conversation we have every single week. Brian today makes me want to have him on about every 6 weeks. Please continue to download. The numbers are great with this thing. Subscribe, leave comments, and I'll talk to you next week, everybody.
The Mike Lupica Podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative. For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lupica Podcast. Click on the Mike Lupica Podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.